Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to another Monday evening NASCA Family Podcast. I am Bailey Smith. I'm your host for tonight. We have tonight a special guest. Her name is Angela Curatello from Orleans, Louisiana. Angelina is the author of two books available on Amazon, Angel, The True Story of an Undeserved Chance and Healing Letters, a 140-day journey to healthy living. As she grew up, her mom abandoned her to her conservative and religious father in Miami. Her dad's wife was very verbally abusive and had a mental illness that caused her to go into rages for minute reasons. Angelina began doing drugs in high school and began prostituting herself out to maintain an addiction to crack. My life was insane, she says, and I believed what I was doing was all I was capable of doing. I'm going to leave it at that for the moment, and I am going to give out our phone number. We'd love to have our callers call in. At 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. I'm still waiting on my co-host, Charlie, to call in. So at this point, I'm going to have to give a brief hold and find out who, which one is our guest. So give me a moment. I'm undertaking a double job here tonight. Again, we want to hear from you guys out there. The panelists really help make our show, and we appreciate when you call in. 646-595-2118. Again, our special guest tonight is Angelina Curatello from Orleans, Louisiana, and I am your host, Bailey Smith. If you can just give me one moment, I will be right back. I'm just finding out. We are back with our guest. I apologize, guys. Angelina, the mic is yours. Normally, how we do this is we just tell our special guest to talk. I'll probably cut you off at some point so that we can have panelists ask you questions. But the show is yours and the mic is all yours as of now. So feel free
okay.
to share. Thank you.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Okay. So my name is Angelina, but, I mean, everybody calls me Angel. And it's been like that since I was very, very small. I was the first grandchild on my dad's side and on my mom's side that was born. And, you know, I don't really spend a lot of time normally on my childhood. Even when I wrote the first book, I didn't spend a lot of time on that. I wrote probably 3 pages and that was it. I spent most of my time talking about things that have happened during a time that I was of age, I was an adult, you know. I tend to look at a lot of the stuff that happened in my childhood as the things that were done to me that were wrong were things that I was powerless over. And so I don't sit around and dwell too much on all of that. I've never really spoken a lot, delving into my childhood. I tend to think more about where my life's been as an adult, and my choices and maybe some other people's choices. But so basically, I'm trying to explain this the best I can. If I were to go into my childhood, I was troubled from the beginning. I was struggling mentally from the beginning. That was way before I started dabbling with drug use as a teenager. I was already a very troubled child. My mom left me on the steps of a hospital, and the doctors said that that, you know, there were cigarette burns there. I was going crazy. The doctors believed at that time that there was some sort of substance put into my body, because it was nothing normal. When I was at that hospital, there was nothing normal about what I was doing. So I guess probably the first thing would be there was definitely an abandonment issue right there. My dad raised me. My mom lost custody due to that and a lot of other things that happened, that there was police reports and all that. So my dad was kind of both parents until he got married. Something that stood out to my family was that I was, you know, my grandmother always said I was always smiling, and she could never understand why. My dad married a woman when I was a child that I thought was wonderful, and I loved her very much. And then when they got married and we were all living together, that was not the woman that I thought that I'd met. And she was very mentally ill, a lot of anger problems. And when I say anger, I mean she'd fly off the handle for no reason. And she was angry all the time, all day, every day. She was just very angry. For whatever reason, as a young person, I was able to discern that something was wrong with her. I knew something was wrong with her. As a child, I didn't know what, and I didn't have, you know, the information I have today as far as all that. But I knew she wasn't normal. I knew that none of this was normal that she was doing. And she was very verbally abusive. I have brought that part up numerous times because that, I think, affected me more than anything as an adult. But she did strange things. You know, she would, if you forgot to take the trash out that night, she would come in the room in the middle of the night and dump the trash on you. You know, just very odd things that she would fly off the handle. So I learned at a young age I would memorize the creaks in the house because we lived in an old house, and I knew when she was coming. I also would never sleep with my back to the door. I needed to be facing the door of my bedroom. That way I could be ready for her when she came in. So a lot of screaming, a lot of hollering, a lot of name calling, stuff like that going on, and just strange things. I would come home from school. She'd throw the, you know, while I was doing my homework, she would lecture for like hours. She wouldn't stop talking. And I immediately learned how to turn her off, and I'd put a wall up. And when I did, I would just go into this never, never land while she would be screaming, and I wouldn't, you know, I'd block her out and just pretend, you know, that I was, that something, you know, wherever my imagination took me other than what was really happening right there. And so I learned how to mentally, I guess you can say, dissociate yourself from everything mm-hmm. being said as a defense mechanism. And it worked for me very well. Something else I learned, because she was very harsh when it came to consequences, something I learned was that I learned this at a really young age, that if I lied about something or I hid something, if I did something wrong, I had a 50-50 chance of not getting caught. And that would save me from all this insanity that would go on if I did get caught, I guess you could say. And so I would hide or lie, just hoping that I wouldn't get in trouble, because the punishments were insane. Like, this was insane. She was very much into perfection when it came to cleaning. So I learned how to be very specific and detailed when it came to cleaning. If I was going to clean something, it would take me forever to do it, because if anything went wrong, she'd freak out. And I mean, just go off, you know. I can remember her taking the blinds, the thing off the blinds, and just hitting me with it. You know, if you missed one spot clean in that kitchen, it was it. You know, it didn't matter all the good stuff you did. What mattered was that one spot that you didn't clean. And so I learned also how to be very specific with details because of that. Now, the other thing was that I was an honor roll student. School was my escape. School was my escape. I was happy at school, and I hated holidays, and I hated summer breaks, because then I was going to be at home listening to all this hollering and fighting, and God knows, she was unpredictable. So all the other kids at school would be super excited about summer and weekends, and I absolutely hated it, you know. I was an honor roll student until I started using drugs. When I started using drugs in school, that's when my grades went completely downhill. She would do things when I was growing up that was like really wrong. Like, I'd have like a bloody lip or bloodiness from her just knocking me in the face or whatever. And then she would always come in the room and she would apologize and cry and say she couldn't help it and she didn't know why she would be the way that she is. And I would always look at her and console her and be like, it's okay, it's okay, you know. But I found out years later that all that I said to her every time she would do things like that, it wasn't okay, you know. It wasn't okay because we'll get to that part of how I figured that out later. But I was also always running away from home. I was always trying to find a way to run away from home. The first time I tried to run away from home, I was in elementary school, and I was in the second grade. And I packed up my little backpack, and my idea was I was going to just walk to Florida. And at that time, we were living in Dallas. But I was going to – I mean, I was in the second grade, so I had no concept of time, miles, none of that kind of stuff. I just knew I wanted to walk to Florida, so I packed up my little backpack, and I started walking when school got out, and the daycare center came looking for me and found me. And by the grace of God, they never told my parents that they had to drive around looking for me. And I just remember being scared to death of what they were going to tell my parents, and they never told them. And they just looked at me and left it alone, you know, the daycare center. Now, something that struck my family is very odd, and I don't normally get into this kind of stuff, but something that struck them and was that at a very young, abnormally young age, I began masturbating. And I think that my first addiction was probably that. And I would do this every night. And there was all this talk of, you know, a possible sexual abuse that they think may have happened when I was really young that I just don't have a memory of. But I'm not too sure because I just know that I was doing that every day by myself, obviously, at night. And I remember getting caught at a young age, and I didn't know it was called that. And I just remember getting the hell beat out of me. I mean, the living hell beat out of me. But because I was addicted to that at a young age, I couldn't stop doing it anyway. And I would just get beat the hell out of any time I happened to get caught, if they happened to walk in my bedroom or whatever. And I knew I was different from the other kids. I had these emotional and mental issues that were not like the other kids, yet I was an honor roll student, and I was always in the little school choirs and always a part of the Christmas productions. And the one thing that I was able to do, that the only thing that I heard growing up that I could do from this woman that raised me most of my life, was that I could sing. That was it. That was the only good thing I could do. Everything else I did was wrong. I, you know, there was not any compliments. There was not, "We're proud of you." There was not none of that. It was always everything I did wrong. And I can remember just feeling like I'm never good enough, no matter what I do. I mean, they didn't see that I made the honor roll. They didn't see that I was in the honor choir at school. They didn't see anything good. They just saw that, you know, saw and even created, the, you know, problems, you know. So when
I think we'll stop here for a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. Did your mother come from an abusive home?
My birth mother's mother did not raise her. Her mother was not in her life. My mother's father raised her, and my aunts and uncles on my mother's side. So my mom, years later, told me that, you know, she didn't have a mom, so she didn't know how to be one. Now, I need to tell you that at the time that my parents had me, it was 1979, and they were both 18 and 19. My mother was 19. My dad was 18. So as an adult, and someone who ended up on drugs and working the streets for crack and doing all this insane stuff, mm-hmm. because I realized their age, and I realized that, well, heck, at that age, I was tricking for crack, okay? Mm-hmm. So I can definitely understand, you know, you have two very young people that had a child and didn't know what they were doing. That was the bottom line. They really didn't know what they were doing or how to do it, I guess you can say. And that helped me so much to look at the reality of where they were at in their life. Now, my stepmother, I always felt like she was my greatest enemy. She was my biggest problem in life because she gave me hell constantly. It was like she hated me, you know. Now, my mother had money, okay? She was married to someone that had money. And she would send these lavish gifts in the mail every holiday. And I would get a box, and it would be all these, it would be like Saks Fifth Avenue clothes for kids. It was very lavish things. Some of those things I got to keep. But if my stepmom noticed that there was something in the box that I fell in love with, she would throw it away. Okay. And it would just break my heart. And then when I would go on trips to see her, because she was in Florida and I was I lived in Texas and in Louisiana during my childhood. So my mother was in Florida, which meant when I went to go see her, I was wined and dined. I have pictures of me with a limousine picking me up from the airport because she would rent a limo to pick me up. And just I was wined and dined, and I was traveling, and my cousins were jealous, always had a problem with the fact that I was able to travel. I had these really nice school clothes, and they just had an issue with me. So I was used to, at a young age, I was used to when you're blessed with something good, people not really being for you, you know, but wishing, but having envy and jealousy that you have something that maybe they don't have, you know. But at the same time, they had something that I didn't have, and their homes were way more stable than mine was. You know, they didn't have all this abusive stuff happening at their house. And I know because I was with them and I grew up with them. And, you know, I used to be jealous of them that they had such a normal household, you know, next to mine. So, she just did strange things. It was very odd. If I was ironing the clothes, God forbid that there be any. If it wasn't done perfectly, you can forget it. When I was ironing the clothes,
it sounds like there was a lot of mental illness. It sounds like there was a lot of mental illness there. I'm going to stop you here. I'm going to give out our number again. Please, we'd love to hear from you. 646-595-2118. 646-595-2118. I'm going to bring on Pamela Elaine from Louisiana so she can ask you questions and make comments. Pamela, take it away.
Okay. Angelina, thank you so much for coming on the show, first off. And second, I want you to just, relax. I know whenever we tell our latter, you know, what happened before and go back, emotions. And I just want you to just pace yourself and relax, you know. If something's triggering you, just, go to another subject. You don't have to stay on the subject. Just, you know, this is your show. You feel comfortable, okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. I just wanted to check on you, make sure you're good. Because, you don't normally go back in time,
Well, Pamela, it's only us and the people listening, so if you have anything else you want to share or comment on or...
No, not right now. I'm just wanting to hear more of her story. I actually met Angelina in New Orleans at a project called You Are Not Alone Project, and I've read her first book. It is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's a page turner. I think it's called Angel. But we'll talk more about that, I'm sure. Yeah, we'll talk more about
the
book. Yeah.
Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So I don't remember or saying anything about having siblings.
Yes. So my mom could not have any more children. And my dad had three more children by my stepmom, and there are huge age gaps between us. I'm put to you like this. I'm old enough to be my youngest sister and brother's parents. My other sister I'm 8 years older than. So, but you have to understand that when they came around, my stepmom was completely different to them. Those were her children, and she was very different with them. They were her pride and joy. That she was stuck raising and taking care of because my mom did not want to raise me. So there was a lot of resentment with her, and a lot of anger at my mom from her. And a lot of, not all, but there was a lot of fighting in the house due to that. Due to the fact that my mom, was not really a mom, really, and that she was having to take on that role. The mental illness thing is huge. Now, I want to say this. The reason I don't go into that too much is because I know for a fact that she was mentally ill. So because I know that there was a legitimate, very serious mental illness there, not condoning or saying what she did was okay, but I really do believe that she could not help the way that she was. Now, my dad was a fixer. Okay, he always got with these women that he wanted. He would never say it, but it appeared to be that he thought he could fix them. And that didn't work. So he would pay for counseling and therapy and medications, psychiatrist visits, whatever it was able. Things that it just didn't make, the things that she did just were very off, and it didn't make sense. Whenever she would whip you with the belt, it was odd. She would pick you up by your ankles and hold you upside down to do it. It was just strange stuff she would do. So I lied a lot if I ever did something wrong. School was my great escape. It was my favorite thing to do. And
I hear that a lot. A lot of people that were abused that talk about that.
School was not a place that I did not want to go to. Now, something else she would do that was really odd. When school would be out, and I remember we lived in a really bad neighborhood for a period of time. It was a really bad neighborhood, very drug infested, very violent, whatever. But my home was close to the school. Where we lived was close to the school. So I could not, at that time, I could not take the school bus because they didn't take you. The reason I was picked up every day from school was because I would have had to walk through the projects to get to my house. And my parents didn't want me walking through the projects to get to the house. So she did not work. This woman did not work ever. The whole time she was married to my dad, she did not work. My dad worked like 2-3 jobs, so he was at home a lot. Okay, that's what that meant. When he came home, he was asleep or eating. You know, that he worked 2-3 jobs to keep everything going. She didn't work at all. And when it was time for me to be picked up from school, she would. There were many, many, many days that she would never even be there on time. And I can remember her not coming until it got dark outside. And I'd be sitting on the curb of the school still waiting for her. And so that really messed me up when it went on for so long, because what I found was when I became an adult, I always had the fear of people not doing what they say they're going to do. You know, things like that. Now, if I fast forward to my teenage years and where I was introduced to drugs, and I immediately fell in love with that. It was very easy for me to use drugs. And obviously my grades went from honor roll down to really bad. And now at this time, I do need to say that when my teenage years started, I moved to Florida to live with my mom. But I want to back up a second on that one because this is a huge piece. When I was in junior high in Louisiana, my stepmom came to me and said that if I did not get out of the house, she was going to divorce my dad, which meant that I would be responsible for the divorce. And I did not want to be the cause of a divorce. And I went to my dad and told him that I wanted to go stay in Florida with my mom because I had never lived with her before, and I wanted to try it out. And all of that was a lie. I did not want to try that out. I was absolutely devastated, and I just talked to my dad, and I'm telling you that it was maybe within a week, I was on an airplane sent to Miami to go to school and to live with my mom, who at that time had grown a lot, had remarried, and was doing okay, you know. I was absolutely devastated. I'd never not lived with my dad before, even though the household was chaotic. It was all that I knew. I saw my dad as kind of my hero at that time because when he was home, he always protected me from my stepmom. The problem was he wasn't home enough because he worked 2 or 3 jobs. You see what I'm saying? So me going all the way to Miami from a small town in Louisiana, not super small, but a small town, and then going to a city of a few million people with a school that's dominantly Latin, and I did not speak Spanish, and I was the white girl with a lot of Cuban friends. But when I got there, I knew no one. I didn't understand the culture. I didn't understand any of it. And that's when my depression, that was when I fell apart, because prior to this, I was in the little school choir. I had lived in the same city for many years, which meant I had friends. I had been part of the same church for quite a few years, and I was involved in that church. And it felt like everything was ripped away from me. And I emotionally depressed whenever I got to Miami. I missed my dad. I missed my sister. I missed my church. I missed school, all of it. And here I was thrown into, that's how I felt. And so when I was introduced to drugs the first time, at that time I was already severely depressed. And when I did it, I just fell in love with it. And that began my part of the story where a lot of my choices started to affect my life. And I did that for a few years, and then I got kicked out of my mom's house because she found out I was using, and she called my dad and said, you know, we can't take it here. You're going to have to take her back. One thing I felt like growing up was that if I did anything wrong, the problem was never dealt with. It was always, well, send her to her mom for a little bit, or send her back to her dad. So the problem was never always just get rid of Angel. Let's just get rid of her and send her to the other parent. And that bothered me when later in life, because I felt like nobody ever tried to address the issue. It was just, I don't want to deal with the issue, so you have to go live over there now. And I took offense to that when I got clean. I took offense to a number of things when I got clean. So got kicked out of mom's and then ended up back at dad's in Louisiana and continued my drug use. then got in trouble again at dad's and was sent back to Miami and to try again, supposedly, try again and to supposedly go to college in Florida. None of that happened because I ended up tricking and then that lifestyle became something I was very attracted to. It was, I think there was a part of me, this is the part that's crazy, I think there was a part of me that was kind of turned on by the street life. I was definitely turned on by people who were rough. The rougher you were, the more I liked you. And I remember these really nice guys or whatever would come in my world, and they were so sweet and so kind, and I couldn't stand it. But if you were a jerk to me, I was turned on, you know. Now, during my tricking and all that, when I got to Florida, I know I'm jumping around, but when I got to Florida, I met this guy that I thought was going to be my husband. You know how that is. I was young. I was probably about 17, 18, and I thought this man was my husband. I believed that. And he had issues and I had issues and we were both using and he started sleeping. And all I remember from that is our relationship was never the same. I could not see him the same. And I think he knew that. Now, I was never going to leave him because this is kind of sick, but this man was beautiful. He was gorgeous. And I remember thinking, I'll never find a guy this hot that's going to want to be with me, so I got to hold on to him. And it did, you know, I tried to push back the fact that he was sleeping with my female friend. And I remember he was interested in threesomes, and he was interested in some things I had never been a part of before. And I did it. I did it because I loved him. I did it. Or at least I thought I loved him. And the way God worked this out was I was never going to break up with this man. I was not doing it. He was going to be my husband one day. Even though I never said that, in my brain he was that. And when he broke up with me, I was devastated. And he broke up with me on Christmas Eve. I'll never forget it. And that was the night that I wanted to get high, and I ran into a crack addict, and I ended up using with them, and that started the whole thing with that. But I truly believe, as insane as this sounds, he knew I was never going to break up with him, no matter what he did wrong, and God knew I wasn't going to break up with him, and our relationship was just the drugs, the sex, the women, the what we were doing was wrong. It was just all messed up. We were both messed up. I think when I look back on it, that it was God that he broke up with me, because I would have never left him. And I would have put up with anything he did wrong, and it would just have continued. And I was never going to stand up for myself, and I was never going to stand, because I felt like it was an honor, even though I never said it, I felt like it was an honor that I could be with somebody that good looking and lose him. And at that point, I was totally attached to him. Unfortunately, I did not know how to handle rejection, and I didn't even know what the word rejection meant. I had never learned that people can move on, or people break up and move on. I was never told how to cope, okay, if there's a breakup, or how to cope. You know, and my only way of knowing how to cope that worked for me was to get high. So that's what I did. But right before that breakup, there were some things going down. You know, we were doing we were both doing things we didn't need to be doing. Now, the issue with me was I never told him what bothered me. So there were things he did that bothered me, but I didn't tell him because I was scared to lose him. So I would just keep it to myself. And there were things I did that bothered him. You know, it went both ways. So when I started tricking in that, you know, there was a very significant thing that happened was when I ran into this chick that I have talked about before. And she was just beautiful to me. She was gorgeous. She really was a pretty woman. And I can just remember seeing her in a crack house and thinking, wow, she smokes crack and she's turning tricks and look at her. Yeah, she looks great, you know. I'm going to be like her. And I remember thinking that I'm going to be like her. And so when she came at me with, you know, the night that I met her, she came at me with saying I could live with her, that she's had the same clients for years in Miami, and they're not dangerous, they're not violent. I would be safe with her. There's drugs, there's sex, there's rock and roll, everything you want. If you come with me, you're going to get it, you know. And I went immediately. It was almost like, it looked like a dream considering. Now, here's the thing about this. Here's where things get weird. I don't look at myself as a victim, okay? I know many people that had bad childhoods. I know many people that have had abuses, you know, probably more so than in the stable household. But as an adult who was already interested in getting high, tricking, and the whole thing, it would not have mattered if it was her or if it was anybody else. I was going to use and trick. This for me was what appeared to me to be the most logical way to do it. And that's the part that a lot of people don't want to talk about. I chose to go with her. I was not kidnapped. I was not with a gun to my head. I chose to go with her. So here's my belief about the streets. And this isn't for everybody. This is just my story. I look at it like this. When you choose the street life, and you choose this, you have to be ready for anything that can go down. You already know that some really bad things can go down. You know, you're walking into chaos. You're saying, I'm okay with this because it's worth it to me to get loaded. So things that happened during my active addiction, if it wasn't her, it would have been anybody, you know, because I had already had made the decision and had been using and had been tricking. To me, she was the safest one to go to. Now, as time progressed, her addiction progressed, my addiction progressed. And it got to a point where she was keeping the crack and the money we were making together. And she might give me one piece and then she would use the rest. Or, you know, things like that started happening. When that started happening and I was strung out at this point and I wasn't getting my money's worth of what I was doing sexually on the street, when that started happening, I attempted to go solo and to get away and go solo. When I did try to go solo in a whole different area of Miami and work for my own drugs and stuff, when I decided to do that, did have something violent that happened to me. So what that did was it was like, okay, you know what, you're not getting all the crap, you're not. My solution in my brain said, at least at her house, you can take a shower and you can sleep and you can eat. And even though you're not getting all the drugs and the money, it's safer than what just happened here. So I went back to her. Now, she was another one I could see. No, I, when I look back on it now, I can look at it and go, God, that was messed up. But once again, just like I had done with the guy, okay, that I brought up about Christmas Eve, once again, she was that person that I just turned a blind eye when she did, or, you know, I turned a blind eye for her. And I overlooked it. And what was insane was everybody else on the street and everything was like, thought it was insane that I kept running with her. I loved her. You know, I understand she was selling me and she was keeping almost everything a majority of the time. But she had this motherly way about her that I loved. So it was a lot of mixed signals between us. Now, as time went by and a couple of new girls came along, and then it was like I wasn't important anymore. When the new girls came along, then she was with them all the time. And I was, that was when I was pretty much, even though I was in her house, I was pretty much on my own. When it came to the tricks and stuff like that.
Can I just stop?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, when you were talking about the guy that you met, that you married him?
No, I did not.
No. Okay. So,
no.
You know,
in my head, we were going to get married. In my
right.
brain, we were going to get married.
You were very young, and you were running away from a bad situation, and you know, people that have been abused that have not gotten the proper help usually go right back to those kind of relationships. Or if they've, or in your situation, your home life was abusive, so you walked right into an abusive relationship or an unhealthy relationship. Even people that have had help, I can say for myself, I come from a domestic violence marriage, and the first real relationship, it was a few years later, that I kind of sort of had, was emotionally abusive. And I saw all the flags and everything, and I had the best help. I already had the help. It's like a desperation almost, or we're so used to the drama. That's the cycle that we ourselves have to break, because I had the help. I was still getting the help. I knew it was unhealthy. But I'm saying, you know, going back to your situation, you know, when you said, you know, I was on the streets and this is a choice I made, you were young. You were abused. You had horrific things happen to you. And it led you, I mean, if you would have had a normal home life and you went that way, yes, it was your choice. But you had to survive. So, as my opinion, yeah.
I found, as insane as this sounds, I loved the people that I was using with on the street. Now, I loved this woman on another level, but I loved the street. And as insane as this sounds, it was safer to me. It was safe. It was, even though it wasn't safe, I didn't deal with on the streets. Obviously, there's issues, but I didn't deal with what I dealt with growing up. That's for sure. Now, I need to back up a minute on this. When I told y'all that I would always, when my stepmom would come in the room and she would cry, and she would do this almost every day, and she'd apologize, and I don't know why I did this, and what's wrong with me, and I would always tell her it's okay, and I would console her, and I did that many, many times. But I told myself in my head when I hit junior high that I would never let somebody, you know, talk to me like that again. I would never let somebody do that again. And that when I was 18 years old, I am out. And I need to say that on my birthday, right before moving to Miami, when everything hit the fan, on my birthday, I grabbed black trash bags out of the kitchen and I started throwing my things in it. And I physically attacked my stepmom. Now, that was when I realized that I had so much resentment towards her because I'm not a physical fighting person. I've never been that person. Even on the street, I wasn't that person, mainly because I was too scared to be that kind of person because I knew what kind of people I was dealing with. But still, I was not a physical fighter. For me to attack this woman, it was almost like years of anger was coming out that one day. And I did exactly what I had told myself for years I was going to do. And that's what I did. And then I was couch surfing, okay, from friend's house to friend's house to friend's house because I had nowhere to go. And then that was when I was sent to Miami. So it was around that time frame. So I didn't realize how much anger I had because when she would be doing all that, I stayed silent. My brain went to another place.
Right. You had.
Yeah, I had. It was by the time I hit that age, that was a wrap for me, you know. And now, if I fast forward a little bit on this, now that I let you know how that happened, in my active addiction.
If you don't mind, I'm going to just give out our number again. 646-595-2118. We do have two people holding. They're listening. They don't want to talk. We did have Bob from Australia, who we lost. My co-host never called in. I didn't know that he was not going to. So I'm going to go back to Pamela, see if she has anything to say, and then you can talk until the end. So, Pam, anything you'd like to share or say? Are you there?
I'm here. I had myself. Hello.
We hear you. Thank you.
I didn't want y'all to hear me.
I know. I was muting myself, too. Thank you for being here tonight because it would have been just me. I don't know what happened to Charlie. He didn't tell me that he's not calling in. And we have two other listeners just listening. I don't even know their names. They didn't offer to give it to them. And we lost Bob from Australia. So it's you and I and Angela. So, and I'm sure many people out there listening.
Okay.
So feel free to
Okay, Bailey?
Mm-hmm. Feel free to talk.
I think what you hit on something that I think maybe Angela doesn't realize. I don't know if she realizes it. The part where you say that because we were so abused and that we were not normal because we weren't growth normal, Angelina, So we left there with baggage, tremendous mental baggage, tremendous emotional baggage. I mean, and where are we going to go? How do we even know what a stable life looks like? You know, the streets is the only place that we go because it's like we're domesticated animals just left out on the street. You know, how are we going to know to act properly? We don't know. We weren't taught to act properly. So it feels normal to us to go into dysfunction, using drugs, drinking alcohol, finding people that are all about the drama and that will abuse us. You know, I mean, that's what feels normal to us. We were raised in that. And so it takes a bit of reflection and, you know, understanding that we went that route because we didn't have a choice at that time. We really didn't, because our, because mentally, you know, we were ravaged people, broken people, you know, our spirits were broken, our hearts were broken, our mentality was broken to pieces. So how are we going to ever just, okay, I'm free now, I'm leaving that house, now I can be normal, now I can think straight, I can act right, I can, you know, find somebody that's going to treat me right. That's not how it works with us. We have to go through a lot to get to normality. What do you think, Bailey? What do you think of this?
No, my situation, our situations are all very different and the same. When I was, before I started to get help, my whole situation just blew up in my face after celebrating 20 years of marriage. I also got married very, very young, and I was the perfect victim. And I didn't even realize I was an abused wife, a mother, abused woman. I knew that there was, things were not 100%, but nobody had anything perfect. I did have a good childhood, and my parents loved each other and respected each other. So, you know, I knew that having, you know, throwing things and screaming and yelling was not normal, and I would open my mouth. But when the main part of my story is when he walked out, which was actually 5 years, was 5 years that this past Saturday, 5 years ago. And after that, up until a year and a half ago, I would say I was tortured because I wouldn't take him back. So when he walked out, and I went through all the craziness, and there were times that I wasn't living with my kids, and he had control over them, and I was searching for the right help because I knew I needed help. I knew this was not. I didn't do drugs. I didn't drink, but I did things to cover up, or to not to cover up, but to the. You want to feel. You're numb and you want to feel. So that's what people do, drugs, or vice versa. They do drugs to numb the pain, or drink alcohol to numb the pain. It was that I did was to feel. I was numb. I mean, it took me a long time to, first of all,
with myself, you know, and Angelina, our stories, we felt dirty and we felt unwanted. So where else do you go but to some place in the street where, you know, all there is filth and you know,
so
stuff going on?
We all do something, we all go somewhere, or we're all trying to fill something, or numb something, or feel something, or whatever it is. So it's very understandable. But, and I was an adult. Well, you know, I'm not ashamed. I don't feel ashamed at what I did. I won't say, it was my choice. I was in a bad place. We are all, when we're in those places, we're in bad places, and we're doing anything we can to survive. And because once I got help and I realized what had been done to me all those years, and I began the healing process, I didn't need to feel anymore. I didn't need to feel that numbness. So, you know, everybody has a situation. It's similar, yet not, you know,
we all went through a trauma, and we do what we can to survive. You know, there are many people that don't survive. So, yes, we were victims. That's how I see us. Angelina may not see herself as a victim. Right now, she's no longer a victim. She was a victim as a child. That's my opinion. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. But we become victims when people do harm to us that we can't control. Now, what we do from there, we can either stay a victim in victim mode, we can do harm ourselves, or we do those things, and then we go to the next level, and that is we get help, and we move on with our lives, and we become survivors and then warriors. And then we go out there and we try and help other people and we try to break that cycle. It doesn't happen again. That's how I see it. So,
when Angelina went to that woman and talked about how that woman comforted her and, you know, was like a mother to her, that was her searching. Yeah, exactly. But, you know,
this was a very odd situation. Because you have to understand that the more strung out I was getting, so was everybody else I was around. You see what I'm saying? So as my addiction was progressing, all the people I was using with, their addiction was progressing too. So we were all, as time goes by, getting worse. And I mean, when it comes to being an addict, you're going to do whatever you got to do to, you know, if it's manipulating, if it's using people, if it's selling, you know, the people and giving them one hit and you're taking the other 10, 20, whatever, you're going to do whatever you got to do to get high and to maintain that high.
Okay. Here's the thing.
I'm not condoning any wrongdoing. I'm saying it's a part of that lifestyle. I'm saying if you go to it, then you're going to deal with anything can happen. So you have to be ready for that. Now, here's what's weird. Even though I had bad experiences using and tricking, I did have bad experiences. However, it didn't come close to what my childhood was like with that woman in the house. You couldn't even touch by the time I was using and tricking, I already knew here from what was going on. So if I was turning a trick, having sex, or if something bad happened on the street, I was able to naturally, automatically go into a whole nother place if I wasn't high at the moment. That was normal for me already. So I was mentally ready and knew how to deal. I'm not saying it was the right healthy way. I'm saying that I already had mastered the defense mechanism to mentally block out what's going on and go into another place. Now, when my stepmom was doing all these verbal things, I can remember still looking at her, seeing her lips moving. I can physically hear you, right? But I'm not taking anything in that you're saying because I'm in a whole nother place. And I can remember another defense mechanism I had is while I was looking at her, I would almost be like talking to myself in my head. I'd be like, Lord, have mercy, look at her. She has lost it. There is something seriously wrong with this woman. Look at her. Look what she's doing. And I would be in my head having a whole conversation. And I could, like I said, I can physically hear you, but I'm not taking in a word you're saying. I can physically hear you, but I'm not processing anything you're saying because you lost me. And that was that was my defense. And I learned anytime I was in a situation that felt like I can't take it, that's what I did. But I had already mastered that as a kid on how to do that. So I want to, though, fast forward from this, because I'd like to touch on how this affected my adult life.
Okay, can
as far as how I deal with things.
Can I just ask you one question before you move on? Okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you're coming out of that and you said, I've finished, and you've beat her up, and you've packed your bags and you've left, why didn't you just go to Wendy's, get a job, you know, take out a loan, get you a place to live, work at Wendy's for a while, get into school? Why didn't you do that?
Well, you have to think, I had already been using for a while at that point.
Oh, really?
I had already been using for a while at that point. So now there's another thing to this, too. I had no self-esteem. I didn't believe I could ever hold down a job or could ever go, you know, go to school. I felt like when you're told that no one ever is going to love somebody like you, you've never been complimented except you can sing good, and that's it. That's all you hear when it's something good. And everything you do is never enough, and that's all you hear. Even though you know that that is wrong and a form of abuse, even though you know all that, it affects your motivation to even try. I felt like, and I'm this is key. This is key, because this was a moment that I had when I turned the trick and the guy said I was good. And when the lady I was telling you about was with us, because she was trying to see what I could do sexually when I started running with her. When he was pleased and she was pleased, I had never heard up to that point that I had done anything good other than sing a song. I was immediately addicted to the compliment from the man saying that I was good, even though we all know they say whatever they say. I remember this sense when I turned the trick of, wow, I'm good at something. I'm actually good at this. Maybe this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Because I didn't believe, especially since I had my own mental illness, you know, I was troubled before I ever did drugs mentally. So for me, I did not believe that I would ever be able to work or go to school, to a college for sure, that I would ever be able to learn or anything like that. So my self-esteem was so squashed that I was at a point where I truly believed that this is what I'm on earth to do, is to turn tricks, because look, I'm making these men happy. I'm hearing good things I'm good at something, and I was turned on by that, and it became an addiction within itself. So much less ever get clean, ever do anything good with my life. That was just, to me, something other people could have as far as getting their life together. I never thought I could. I always saw myself like, well, yeah, they can work, they can move up, they can get the degree, they can get clean, they can do all this. But me, I'm crazy, I'm weird, I'm not like them.
I'm trying to ask you, okay, you made the point that when you become an adult, that's your choice. But would you go back and kind of say that the type of adult you became because of your childhood, you really didn't have a choice? In a way,
I think that if my family knew how to address issues and how to get help for those issues, instead of
throwing you around like a rag doll.
Right. Like we're gonna send her there. I think if there were some solutions, some healthy solutions, I'm going to tell you what I really believe about the school system. I believe there should be courses on relationships. I believe these kids need to have courses on healthy relationships. I believe kids need it. I believe before you can get your high school diploma that there should be mandatory curriculum for how to heal from things, how to communicate healthy, how to have healthy relationships. Because here's the thing, you can have all the degrees in the world. You can be the top-notch person or somebody who is successfully driven. But if you can't communicate normally, and I know we're not supposed to say that, but if you don't know how to have a business conversation without getting personal, if you are lashing out, if you're using people, I'm just saying that to me, that is just as important on how well you can read and write and add and subtract.
I have to stop everybody right here. I have to stop here because we have a caller. Kathy from Maine is on. So, Pamela, I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to mute you for right now. I want to just tell you, Angelina, one of the things that schools need to have, exactly what you just said, and going along with that is mental health, violence, bullying, all the above they need to implement in the school system because they're preparing them for life, for leaving and going out into the world and going, whether they go on to college or whatever. They need those skills, and they're not getting it at school. And unfortunately, a lot of kids are coming from broken homes, so they're not getting it from their home either. So you're right. And thank God, I think today there's a lot in school as far as social workers and guidance counselors that are there for kids if they want to talk about what's going on at home and things like that. So it's different, I think, now when it comes to, children feeling safe, having a safety place to go in a school. Some schools, I don't know if all schools, but I do agree that they have to implement that. But let's bring Kathy on. Thank you, Kathy, for calling in. We really appreciate it. Any questions for Angelina?
Well, I read her bio and the intro, and I have not been able to listen to the first part of the show, but I've been listening to the last few moments about the educational system, and I'd certainly like to see the teachers teach the students how to read and write before we have teachers who probably don't even have decent marriages of their own try to teach children how to have good relationships. However, I think if the schools are broken,
I don't think it should be teachers. They need to bring in mental health counselors.
Okay.
Go on.
I'd like to finish my thought, but if you just want to disagree with me before I can finish it, I agree with you. There should be counselors, and there are, and people should take it. But if you want to fix the broken schools, I don't think necessarily adding on things they're not clearly trained to do is probably not a good idea. I think we should fix the reading and writing. But no, I agree with you 100%. There should be people to go to. But I think the families need to be fixed. I think we should put our lives into the families. I think we should pay attention. I was the recreation chairman for 6 years down at the place through the 90s, and I can assure you, you can tell when you see the kids all the time, year after year, swimming parties and stuff through the neighborhood. The families are there, and I must say it's nice that there's someone that they can talk to from time to time and have had the opportunity to intervene. But I do find a lot of people also, and I did hear the beginning of the drug addiction and the 12-step programs and many people who are abused. I'm an adult survivor of incest, and I don't know if I mentioned that. Anyway, I don't know that that's always the fallback on everyone, and it wasn't for me. I know my family, my brother and sister were, the other brother and sister were very heavily involved into drugs, and they went, the family was extremely dysfunctional, and they had extreme abuse in many fashions. They just weren't raped by the eldest brother like I was. But they both went into deep drug problems, and very bad things. And, you know, so I'm just saying it doesn't always happen. I was lucky I got out of there, you know, got away, kept moving. Distance can be helpful. But, you know, I do see books were written. Angelina, you published some books. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're working on another one?
I just started another one recently, yeah.
How do they go? I see a lot of books written and talking about our stories, and horrific as they are, and certainly the failure to be responded to properly from the time it happens until we're, you know, almost 70 years old, you know, or whenever. And I just wanted to know, because I see so many people write books, and I don't see them on the bestseller, and they're beautifully written, and I'm certainly not knocking them at all, but I just find that those of us who get it are buying them and reading them and telling each other how much we love each other and have compassion for each other, which we do. But the rest of the blind people keep their heads in the sand and don't buy those books. And I wanted to know whether you think it's helpful for you to write the book, or are we making a difference by telling our stories?
We are making a difference,
a good question.
I think.
That's
I
a good question.
So.
I think you are. Here's the thing. It's not about numbers. It's not about numbers. It's about if one person is touched. That's it. If one person gets a revelation.
Yeah, I felt that way when I was doing the recreation things and the people coming out and the children, and when they touch. I couldn't understand why this one child was treated so different. Everybody else was treated normally, but when he came out, it was like they treated him as if he was an object. This just doesn't fit right. So, one time, one person, one kid at a time, and you got to open your eyes, and you got to know what to look for and see. And, you know, you got a whole school full of kids and one counselor and a teacher trying to it's a lot. And so, it takes a lot of investigative look, and it does, and I'm not knocking telling our story doesn't help. I mean, I've been through decades and decades of this, and for God's sakes, people don't even want to listen, you know, 30 years ago. And now, we hear more, and we hear more. You know, person's famous, they matter. But I will tell you.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about that, and some people don't know this coming into it. You have to have a tremendous, tremendous amount of money for a book to have that kind of marketing. Like, you see what I'm saying? If you don't have the money, okay, I can tell you that just Barnes & Noble themselves. Okay.
Tell me something. Every time you walk
into Barnes & Noble and see a book on their shelf,
we only have a couple times, and I think this is really a follow up exactly on what you say. Tell me something. Would forwards from other accomplished and good sales authors give you that open door? Help? If you had forward written by I don't know who, you know, you got some great person who can write a forward to your book, who you could bring it
to. Well, obviously, if there's somebody influential, very influential, that's going to make a difference if you even have that kind of connection. You know what I'm saying?
So that's what you need to do is you need to find the connection.
It's a lot more to it. It's a lot more to it than just,
It's wonderful to write the books, and I admire so many, and I've picked up a few, and And, you know, I come back to the same starting point. Here I am reading it. Here I am seeing it. And I know the rest of my brothers and sisters in NASCA also are from the same viewpoint, see. But now my phone's going to go dead, and I appreciate your having the time. And I'm going to have to go once again on the computer, and hubby's not well, so I have to in and out.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you for
and
the time. It's beeping on me.
I think writing your book and writing your story is for yourself and to help others. And the people that want the help are
I admire your passion in putting it into it. Thanks. I got to go. It's going to die. Love ya.
The people that want to get the proper help, to get that kind of help, are going to read the book. And I think the people that write the book, it's a healing process for them, because I'm in the early stages of writing mine. And I think that you have to go out there once you've written it, and you have to promote it. I mean, we're on this show bringing awareness to what happened to you, what happened to all the other people that come on to the show, what happened to me. I'm a host. I'm an advocate. You know, it's a lot of work, and we're doing it for, well, if you make money on your book, that's great, but we're doing it to bring awareness and to help, like you said, reach that one person.
Right.
If you reach one person, you did your
job.
That's
right. If you get, here's what I learned a long time ago with this.
I'm gonna bring Pamela back.
I learned this a long
time.
Okay. Yeah, I learned a long time ago on this that you cannot, if you get. I love numbers. Numbers are awesome. They're a motivator. But you're going to be really let down and disappointed if you have such a high expectation. Like, literally, you have to tell yourself to not get attached to the outcome. The outcome is up to God. As long as I do my part, the outcome's up to God. I just do what I'm led to do. And that's it, you know, because if you think too much about it, and I've been both ways. I've been the one that's been able to be unattached to the outcome, and I've had times where I've been attached to the outcome, and I felt hurt. You know, that's the risk you take with everything in life. If you think about it, anything you try out, it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, you know, and all you do is – I look at it like this. I'm not going to go to bed at night with regret, right? If God puts something on my heart to do, I do it, okay? And I do it because I know if I don't do it, I'm going to regret and wonder what could have happened. So I'm always about give it a shot, you know, see what happens. Because if you don't want to be in the nursing home one day going, I wonder what would have happened if I would have gave in to that amazing idea I had of something I wanted to do. You know, I don't want to be that person. I've always been like, if something's put on your heart to do, go for it. It may or may not work. It's a 50-50 deal. And everything in life, when people start businesses and everything in life, you know, it's a Russian roulette. You know, sometimes it takes off and sometimes it doesn't.
You know what, I believe we have a little less, and I believe when you are very passionate about something, and I believe we all go through what we go through for a reason, because there's no other way to understand why God would, or a higher power would put us through such a horrific situation. So I had to say to myself, I went through what I went through to help other women and men out there. And Pamela, you're off of mute. It's set to you, by the way.
Okay.
No, there's background noise. So basically, and that's what I'm doing. I'm out there, just on every platform of social media that I can be, and I have reached people because I get messages, and I've done plenty of podcasts, and a majority of the podcasts, I mean, all the podcasts I did, other than this one, where I was asked, well, I was asked to tell my story, and then I asked if I wanted to volunteer. But all of them came to me and said, would you like to be on my show? And I shared my story, and I reached however many women I reached that did give me feedback. And that is rewarding, because as I'm helping them, they're helping me. Because that's
right.
How we heal. We heal.
That's
by
exactly
talking.
How it goes. It goes both ways. It goes both
right.
ways.
And by talking and by writing is how we heal, and by getting help. That's my personal
right.
opinion. And you know, you wrote your book. I didn't get a chance. To look at it or anything today, but.
Well, Angel,
yeah, go on.
I mean,
sorry,
yeah.
We have about 90 seconds, so let's finish up
okay.
here. If Pamela wants to say something quickly, or Angelina.
Yeah, Angel is under Angel Marie. That's your Facebook, right, Angel Marie?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
You may be.
That's
on,
your Facebook.
Okay.
And I just wanted you to contact her if you're listening to the show and you want to, you know, get in contact with her, please do that. And then I just want to thank you, Angelina, for coming on and telling your story like you did. I hope that you learned something from us, and I know we learned stuff from you, and I just want to thank you.
Well, thank
yes.
you.
And the final 40 seconds, 30, 35 seconds, what would you like to say?
I would just say that, you know, when – we're adults, you know, we are responsible for getting the healing that we need and for not using our past and the things that were done wrong as a reason to hurt others as an adult. And that if we heal, we won't take out those issues we have on everyone that crosses our path. And that's the goal, is to take responsibility for what do I need to do for me so I can be a better me. But when I'm a better me, I'm a better me to everybody else too. And as my life gets healthier, my relationships get healthier, and everything around
exactly.
me gets better. But I'm responsible for that, and I can't use my childhood and the things other people did to me as an excuse to continuously hurt me and hurt others. We're responsible
right.
for our healing. That's the bottom line. Can only
sure.
play the victim so long. You can only, you know,
agreed.
At some point
agreed.
You have to be victorious. At some point you have
agreed.
To quit crying and
agreed.
Complaining, you know. At some point you have to say, you know what, I got one life to live. I'm an adult now. What do I need to work on in my life right now that, you know, so I can be better?
Well, thank you so much, Angelina, for being our special guest this evening. Please check out her book on Amazon, Angel, The True Story of an Undeserved Chance and Healing Letters, The 140-Day Journey to Healthy Living. And thank you so much again for being on the show. Thank you for the people that called in and listened to the entire show. I appreciate it. Sorry, Bob, we lost you. Thank you, Pamela, for calling in and being kind of my co-host. And thank you, Kathy, for calling in. And God bless you all. And may we have happy holidays and a fresh new year coming up in a couple of weeks. Have a good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You are forgotten.
Radio.